is 77 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 76 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM.
The evil warmongering Zionist won. No, not that one, the other one. The Democratic Party has lost control of both the White House and the Senate. As of this writing, it is still unclear which party will secure control of the House of Representatives. Turns out campaigning on the promise of continuing a genocide while courting endorsements from war criminals like Dick Cheney is not a great way to get progressives to vote for you. One interesting point is that Donald Trump appears to have taken the battleground state of Michigan, where Kamala Harris was soundly rejected by the large Arab American population of Dearborn, despite voting overwhelmingly for Biden in 2020. Back in August, Harris famously shushed Muslim anti-genocide protesters at a campaign rally in Michigan by admonishing them with the words, "I'm speaking." Well, who's speaking now? To be clear, this is not a good result. A good result was not possible this election. The warmongering Zionist genocide monster lost, which means the other warmongering Zionist genocide monster won. Donald Trump is still bought and owned by Adelson Cash, which means we can expect him to be just as much of a groveling simp for Israel as he was during his first term. The president-elect has publicly admitted that when he was president, the Zionist plutocrats, Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, were at the White House probably almost more than anybody asking him to do favors for Israel, like moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and acknowledging Israel's illegitimate claim to the Golan Heights, which he eagerly did. Trump closed out his campaign tour alongside his former CIA director and Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, which should be enough to dash the hopes of even the most naive Trump supporters that U.S. foreign policy is headed in a positive direction in January. As CIA director, Pompeo led a plot to assassinate Julian Assange and cheerfully admitted that, quote, "we lied, we cheated, we stole," end quote, at the agency. This odious swamp creature has remained in Trump's good graces for the last 8 years and is reportedly expected to have a position in Trump's cabinet once again. Speaking at a campaign event in Pittsburgh on Monday, Pompeo boasted that he has been called the most loyal cabinet member to Donald J. Trump and said that when Trump is reelected, "we will take down the Ring of Fire. We will support our friends in Israel." The Ring of Fire is think tank speak for Iran and the militias in Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Palestine who oppose Israel. So things are probably going to get uglier and uglier. But they were getting uglier and uglier under Biden, and they would have gotten uglier and uglier under Harris as well. That's just what it looks like when you've got a dying empire fighting to retain planetary control like a cornered animal. You don't get to be the U.S. president unless you are willing and eager to do ugly things. Democrats exaggerate how destructive Trump is relative to their own bloodthirsty psychopath candidates. While we can expect Trump to inflict tyranny and abuse upon Americans, it will be nothing compared to the tyranny and abuse he's going to inflict on people in other countries. And it will be nothing compared to the tyranny and abuse his predecessor has been inflicting on people in other countries. All the histrionic shrieking we see from U.S. liberals about Trump only works within a Western supremacist worldview that does not see the victims of U.S. warmongering as fully human, and therefore sees scorched earth genocidal atrocities as less significant than comparatively minor abuses concerning U.S. domestic policy. Abandon hope that any positive changes will come from this election result. Abandon hope that Trump will do good things. Abandon hope that Democrats will learn any lessons from this loss. Abandon hope that liberals will suddenly remember that genocide is bad and start protesting against the U.S.-backed slaughter in Gaza. Abandon hope in U.S. election results, period. U.S. elections do not yield positive results. They are not designed to benefit ordinary human beings. Nothing changes for those of us who are dedicated to fighting against the abuses of the U.S. empire. It will be the same fight after January 20th as it was on January 19th. We fight on.
The Shai Rana Show, and you just heard Tom Foley reading a commentary by the Australian commentator, Caitlin Johnston, about her position on the election. Several things, obviously, as you heard kind of assessment that obviously nothing good. We knew this, but it's pretty incredible when the incompetence of the Democratic Party, that, for example, in the final hour, where people like are standing on the fence or riding the fence, basically, they send Bill Clinton to push him over. Bill Clinton, who has always been a racist when it comes to Arabs, and who's full of himself because he was told once that he was the first black president. I don't know why, because he passed the crime bill, he passed the immigration bill, he passed a bunch of stuff that Reagan had prepared us ideologically for. So they send us Bill Clinton to the Arab community, to a swing state like Michigan, where he tells them the reason why women and children are being killed is because they are to blame, that the community, that the Arab community is to blame for that, and that pushed them over the fence. Not that that's the sole. There's also the youth vote, there's also the black vote, there's Latino vote. There's a lot of blame to go around that I'm sure. Right now, hardcore Democrats who never lifted a finger in the past year to fight genocide. They were all good Germans, and now they're speaking out. And as military analyst and commentator Greg Stoker said, that now the liberals will go to brunch for 3.5 years and come back 3.5 years to defend Kamala Harris, will be running against Tom Cotton. That's the reality of the passivity of these people that are now saying that we are to blame, that minorities are to blame, that the youth are to blame, etc. My favorite thing, commentary about the election, came from the Arab, Sicilian, and Greek mixture in ethnicity of Frank Zappa, the pop singer, who said politics is the entertainment division of the military industrial complex. That is indeed right. They both parties have to answer to the military industrial complex. That's ultimately what they are. They're middle managers for Lockheed Martin, for Boeing, for Northrop, for all of these weapons manufacturers that are at the heart of our economy. And I want to remind you also that during Biden's reign, basically, he always gave the Pentagon more than they were asking for during that time. It's not just about the fact that they supported genocide, but they've made the world a much more dangerous place and made the world more acceptable to the monsters like Donald Trump. They basically established what is the baseline for what's considered the baseline for evil, so that they pose themselves as a lesser evil when 110,000 Palestinians were killed with their US weapons. 73% of the war was financed by the United States. And that's what they that the growth of these the military industrial complex under Biden is what's making this world a more dangerous place. And the two fronts that the US is fighting on is basically depleting its security, it's depleting its military, and it's diverting all energy from the biggest threat to our security, to our safety, to our health, climate change. After Liz Cheney and Dick Cheney, who had killed his wars on false pretenses, just like this war that's happening now, that's on false pretenses. Dick Cheney, they decided that's who they were going to court, rather to court their base, and that's who they decided to parade. While they were telling us to shut up, they told Liz Cheney to speak up. They told Dick Cheney to speak up, and they told us to shut up. I'm speaking here. That's what we were offered by the Democratic Party. We were ordered to shut up, and these Republicans and these neocons were told to speak up. And they wonder, when we say that you provided fertile ground for the right wing to grow, that's exactly what we mean. That when you court the right wing, you get the right wing. And that's where we stand today. We're in for a rough 4 years for me personally, and for a lot of people that have had the most difficult year of their lives in the past, that they've been most impacted by in the quarter of a century that I lived in this country. I've never suffered as much as I suffered in the last year, not under any president. I've never suffered this much under the most reactionary Republicans. I've never suffered this much loss in every sense, in career, in extended family, in property destruction. 25% of my beloved South Lebanon has been flattened. 25%, 43 villages completely wiped out, all the while to allow Israel to advance and invade and occupy again. When, of course, when it comes to the ground war, we have soldiers who are good at video games. That's the IDF fighting real men. We have real men fighting mice, and that's why Israel is losing the ground war and trying to compensate as they do, because Biden allowed them to do it, because Harris allowed them to do it, and because Trump will allow them to do it, and to go on steroids too. That there is no red line. They can kill children. They can fry children. They can kill people in hospitals. They can kill journalists. They can destroy universities. They can destroy schools. They can destroy ambulances. They can kill medics. they can shoot kids in the head. That was all done with the approval of Biden and with the approval of Harris. So these last days where the Democratic Party put out competing ads in Michigan, one that said, promised that they're fighting for a ceasefire, and one that said that they're fighting for Israel, as if social media doesn't exist to bring these two outlets and these two ads together to show the hypocrisy of it and to take it into a kind of a viral distribution. That's what we're dealing with. And these kinds of, what do you call them? These kind of like tricks that they've used is what made them made us lose trust, made progressives, not just sets of minorities, but the youth that doesn't depend on mass media, that depends on things that are coming straight from the ground. That's what they saw, and that's why they lost trust. And with that, we're gonna go to our next clip, which is a long one, and it's an interview that was done with Ambassador Chas Freeman on Israel's devastating defeat that's happening right now. As you know, Netanyahu just basically fired Gallant as you know, the leading military figure, and replaced him with somebody even more hawkish than Gallant. I mean, remember, Gallant is the one that called Palestinians subhuman and animals, and wanted to basically wipe them out, you know, in rhetoric. But he had been trying to push Netanyahu in a different direction, especially with the ground war being as it is, and them losing the ground war. That didn't work for Netanyahu, because, as you all know, that Netanyahu is continuing this war because he, as soon as it stops, you know, just like one of his aides was arrested just yesterday, he will have to face many charges of corruption. And here we moved our whole nation, the United States of America, for the ambition. The Democratic Party bet and fed that ambition. It's a personal ambition. It's not even something that benefits the United States. I mean, the whole point of Israel was supposed to be that it is a sort of an unsinkable aircraft carrier for the United States, meaning that it was supposed to defend the United States' interests, not have the United States send in $22 billion to prop it up, or send in military personnel, our working class people that are joining to go to college and being killed as cannon fodder for the ambition of this man. You know, the idea that we have to intervene in order to save, you know, it was supposed to be the hijack state. It was supposed to be the watchdog on other nations, and instead it has shredded the social fabric of everything around it, and now is facing the comeuppance right here. So with that, let's listen to Ambassador Chas Freeman, who was, by the way, the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and listen to the crystal clear truth that he tells about what's happening right now.
Hi, today's Friday, November 1st, and Ambassador Chas Freeman is here with us. Welcome back, Ambassador.
Glad to be with you.
And let's start, Ambassador, with what has happened between Iran and Israel, Israeli attack on Iran. Israelis are talking that they have destroyed Iranian air defense system and they could hit all the targets they wanted to hit. On the Iranian part, we've learned that the Supreme Leader of Iran recently said that we don't have to exaggerate nor understate what has happened in Iran. What's your take on what has happened?
Well, this was a moment in which both sides appeared briefly to have adopted a measured response to each other. That is, under American pressure and with the incentive of additional American support in the form of THAAD, the Theater High Altitude Interceptor System on Israeli soil. Two of the nine such systems in the world are now in Israel. Israel adopted a relatively reduced, restrained approach to attacking Iran, not at all what it had originally threatened. And so and that in effect reciprocated Iran's rather restrained attack on October 1. Iran could have done much more damage than it did, and it aimed only at military targets. Similarly, Israel this time seemed to have, for once, avoided attacking civilian targets and aimed only at military targets. So both sides have now exchanged restrained, measured reprisals against each other. I think it is foolish to imagine that this is the end of the tit for tat. I note that the head of the Iranian armed forces has now threatened a very robust response to Israel. And I think on the Israeli side too, there are domestic political pressures for a much larger attack on Iran. The danger now is not just that Iran will go all out in an attack on Israel, because basically it has reached the conclusion that there is no way to deal with Israel except with all-out attack, given the lack of restraint on Israel's part elsewhere with southern Lebanon and northern Gaza. That's not the only danger. The pattern of the Israeli attack on Iran suggests that at least part of it was aimed at degrading Iranian air defenses sufficiently to enable a much larger attack in the future. Now, the last point I would make is each side mirrors the other. Israel says, well, October 1, the Iranians really didn't do very much damage to Israel. Iran says, well, they didn't destroy our missile production capabilities. We can still mix solid fuel in our facilities. They did not succeed in taking out our air defenses. And indeed, Iran has just fielded a new shorter range air defense system of its own design. So each side is underplaying the amount of damage that it suffered. And each side is exaggerating the amount of damage the other suffered. This is okay. The problem is that Israel, at least, has a history of inhaling its own propaganda and believing its own propaganda rather than taking foreign assessments into adequate account. And the presence of the THAADs in Israel, instead of restraining Israel in the long run, probably will be taken by Israelis to enable a much more risky strategy toward Iran. So we're in a very dangerous moment. The Ayatollah Khamenei was very careful in his initial statement. Clearly, Iranian politics have pushed Iran in a more ferocious direction. And I think this is a moment, whether they will wait before the election in the United States, November 5th or not, is a question Some Israelis seem to think that attacking Iran before November 5th would help Mr. Trump at the polls. I don't see the logic of that. Other Israelis, I think, more sensibly argue that the time after November 5th, when Mr. Biden, who is an ardent Zionist, is still in power, but freed from political concerns, would be a better time to attack. So in one way or another, I think we're going to see at least one more round of mutual aggression. And that will not be the end of this. Iran has been a nation state in one form or another for 2,500 years. It's not going to go away. And Israel, by contrast, is a recently established state with no demonstrated capacity to endure suffering. I think one of the strengths of Islam is the ability to absorb suffering and accept that it is the will of God, and to accept that death on behalf of a righteous cause is something to be celebrated. It is martyrdom, and it raises your value in the eyes of God rather than lowering them. So this is a contest between cultures. It is a contest between strategic perceptions. It is a contest to establish or avoid establishing Israeli hegemony in the region. And I don't think Iran can, in the end, resist a robust response.
Recently, Naftali Bennett had an interview with Fox News in which he addressed many issues of what they're dealing with in the Middle East. Here is what he said about Iran and their plan about Iran.
Prime Minister of Israel, Naftali Bennett, to discuss what's next. And sir, let's begin there. What is next? What are the prospects of some sort of ceasefire in the near future?
Well, Israel seeks quiet and security in the region. We want peace, but in order to achieve peace, we have to neutralize the source of war and the source of terror, and that's the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's sort of the head of the octopus of terror in the entire Middle East. Where we stand right now is that Israel has severely weakened the arms of the octopus, Hezbollah and Hamas. We've also rendered Iran's ability to defend itself. We've diminished their ability to defend themselves. And now it's time to hit the head of the octopus, the nuclear program, and the regime itself.
You actually said that same thing on October 2nd, following the ballistic missile attack on Israel. You said Iran had made a terrible mistake and that Israel had its greatest opportunity in 50 years to change the face of the Middle East. That was October 2nd. Have you lost that opportunity?
I don't think so. I think ultimately we should look at this in a whole perspective. And what matters is what we do next. Do we just let go of Iran and let them replenish themselves and fix their air defenses and then beginning rearming the whole octopus in Lebanon and Gaza? Or do we go all in and take out their nuclear program and ultimately help the Iranian people topple this terrible regime that's been ruining their own lives for the past decades? So I think what really matters is what's next.
Yeah. Two things. Just militarily, they want to crush Iran. And on the other hand, they want to have some sort of regime change in Iran.
This is a stellar example of hubris, excessive pride that leads to a fall. His strategic assessment is bogus. It cannot be taken seriously. First of all, it omits, it reverses cause and effect. the reason Palestinians resist Israeli oppression is because of the oppression. It is not because Iran directs them to do so. There is no tentacle from the head of the octopus, a ridiculous image, I think. Actually, I grew up in the Bahamas. I knew lots of octopuses, and they were generally very gentle, not ferocious. But anyway, Hezbollah is defending Lebanon and Lebanese nationalism against Israeli violations of Lebanese sovereignty and humiliations of the Lebanese government. It is not following the directions of Iran. It has support from Iran because Israel constantly threatens Iran. I was asked as ambassador to Saudi Arabia in 1992, which is quite a long while ago, 32 years ago, to go and brief the then Crown Prince, Abdullah, to the effect that Iran was 2 years away from building a nuclear weapon. Well, that was 32 years ago. It still hasn't built a nuclear weapon. So there is a lot of nonsense here. I don't think it is the case that Iran is unwilling to reconcile with Israel. After all, historically, Iran had quite a good relationship with Israel. And I seem to remember that even after the establishment of the Islamic Republic, there was the Iran-Contra affair, where Israel was arming Iran. So the Israelis basically, and I think this is very clear from what Mr. Bennett said, are aiming to establish escalation dominance, meaning the ability to overwhelm, or the perceived ability to overwhelm any attacker with a greater counterattack, and also supremacy, military supremacy in the region. Israel's basic strategic doctrine appears to be that it cannot live alongside anyone it has not subjugated or subordinated. This is where the idea, the ridiculous idea of regime change in Iran comes in. I'm sure there are many Iranians who would rather have a different regime, but Israel has united Iranians behind the current leadership and the Iranian military. It has not divided Iranians. So the idea that somehow or other an attack on Iran, however severe it was, would lead to regime change is, at least on the surface, preposterous. Now, finally, Israel has learned, its military have learned, two things. First, Israel cannot defend itself adequately against Iran without American and British and other foreign support. And even with that support, it cannot stop Iran from successfully penetrating its defenses. So the first point is misplaced self-confidence in Israel's ability to blunt an Iranian attack is very risky. Second, it is quite apparent it is obvious to the Israeli leadership that they cannot destroy Iran's nuclear program by themselves. This is one reason they have been trying to drag the United States into a war with Iran, because only with American participation can they hope to set back, not destroy the Iranian nuclear program. The Iranian nuclear program, which has stopped short so far of building a bomb, is now under pressure to do that, to build a bomb, because of the constant threats from Israel. So what Israel is doing is directly counterproductive. It risks grave damage to its own society. It risks a wider war in which it will be the subject of attacks from all quarters. It risks alienating those it has not already alienated in the world. And it has no prospect, barring an American, a foolish American decision to join it in attacking Iran, it has no prospect of achieving its objectives vis-a-vis Iran. So this is the sort of overweening pride, overweening overreach in judgment that leads to disaster, not victory. You know, there is, finally, I would just say, you know, there's the famous quote from Sun Tzu, the great Chinese military theoretician, who said, if you know yourself and know your enemy, you will always be victorious. But if you don't know yourself and you don't know your enemy, you will lose every war. Well, Israel does not understand itself. It thrives on its own propaganda. It does not have a correct perception of its own situation in the world or in the region. And it certainly does not understand either Iran or the source of Arab resistance. And so this is not Mr. Bennett has been nothing if not consistent. And so far, the objective set out by Israel for its war of annihilation and extermination against the Palestinians and the Lebanese has not been realized. It has not conquered Hamas. Hamas is still operating. It is recruiting like crazy among Palestinians, not just in Palestine, but in the diaspora. Hezbollah is not defeated. It is continuing to escalate its counterattacks on Israel, and it is giving Israeli ground forces in southern Lebanon a very hard time indeed, with lots of casualties. So Israel needs to pull itself up short and discover realism as opposed to delusion as the basis of policy.
In your opinion, when he talks about the color revolution, in my mind, he's talking about he wants to topple the government in Iran, he's aiming at some sort of color revolution, having the escalation between Iran and Israel and doing some sort of color revolution in Iran. We've seen this recently in Georgia. And do you think, is there any sector in the United States who are in the same line as Naftali Bennett and these people are in Israel and thinking that they can do some sort of color revolution in Iran?
I imagine there is, yes. If you look at the neoconservatives or people like Mr. Bolton, you will find that they support terrorist organizations aimed at overthrowing the government of Iran. Whatever you think of the government of Iran, it is the government of a sovereign nation, and it is entirely inconsistent with international law and custom for Americans or anyone else to be conducting covert action aimed at destroying it or at dislodging that government. But I think, in fact, the example of Georgia is apposite, because there was quite an effort made to claim that the recent elections in Georgia somehow were a contest between a pro-Russian regime and an alternative that was allied with Europe and the West. And in the end, the people of Georgia, I think in a very fair election, repudiated the idea of the overthrow of the regime. They understand that their strategic position does not give them the luxury of having a hostile relationship with Russia, and that they need to be somehow between East and West. That is, they may be able to join the European Union at some point, but they surely should not align themselves militarily against Russia, because that would be fatal. And I think probably Iranian voters, who after all do function in a guided democracy, it is a democracy. It is a guided democracy in which certain positions are ruled out of order for the elections. Frankly, although that is open and institutionalized in Iran, it's not that different from other democracies. There are opinions in the United States, for example, the majority of the people of the United States want an end to arms sales to Israel and do not want a war with Iran, do not want a wider war in the Middle East, Probably a majority now are against continuing to support Ukraine in the manner we have. And yet our political elite rules their views out of order and proceeds as though they didn't exist. So in one of the phenomena that has emerged, which is deeply disturbing everywhere, is elite opinion ignoring popular opinion, manipulating it, but not taking it into consideration. So there is a gap between the political establishment and the society as a whole. And this calls democracy into disrepute, and it threatens it. And this is the case in almost every democracy that I know these days.
There were reports from a high-ranking Lebanese security source. He's saying that the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, Ambassador Johnson, is continuing her agenda to prepare Lebanon for post-Hezbollah era by mobilizing. When you look at the way that they're trying to manipulate the system in Lebanon, while they're having this conflict, this war at the southern part of Lebanon, do you think that in their mind, at the same time, they can diminish the power of Hezbollah in Lebanon?
Well, that's the objective. It is an Israeli objective, obviously. It has been embraced by the United States. The symbol of that is the decision of the Biden administration to appoint an Israeli dual national and veteran of the Israeli Defense Forces, Amos Hochstein, as the American envoy for Lebanese matters. Can you imagine the United States appointing an Arab American, a Muslim American, as the envoy to deal with Israel? This is very clearly alignment with Israel against Lebanon. The United States has designated Hezbollah as a terrorist organization because it resisted by terrorism an American intervention in Lebanon years ago. It did so in a very disgusting manner, and those Americans who died in it have family members who will never forgive Hezbollah. Okay, we all have grievances from the past, but we have to look instead to the present and the future. And dismembering Lebanon, which is what Israel is proposing to do by essentially annexing everything up to the Litani River, guarantees a permanent state of war in the Middle East, in West Asia. This is in no one's interest except in the misguided view of Mr. Netanyahu, in his interest. And I think that history will judge him as the cause if Israel fails to continue to exist, which is entirely possible. This will be laid on Mr. Netanyahu's shoulders. He will be seen much as Hitler was seen. Hitler is correctly blamed by Germans for having led them down the wrong path to a path of destruction and the discrediting of the German nation. And Mr. Netanyahu is doing the same thing for Zionism and Israel.
And here is the second part of what Naftali Bennett said on Fox News.
It must be very frustrating. You've taken out the leader of Hezbollah, Hamas, but surely those groups just find someone else to lead them. The ability to crush these proxies of Tehran is very difficult. And what's to stop them once again reforming and going back to what they were before this war began?
Well, that's a very good question. The answer is the way to stop the arms of the octopus from reforming, rebuilding themselves is by hitting and ultimately cutting off the head of the octopus. That's the only way. If you don't do that, you're absolutely right. The arms and tentacles will ultimately rebuild themselves and continue fomenting terror for the next 50 years.
Prime Minister, I want to get your reaction to this, if I could. J.D. Vance spoke about American involvement in the Middle East and its role in the Israeli-Iran conflict. Listen to this, and then I'll get your comments.
Israel has the right to defend itself, but America's interest is sometimes going to be distinct. Like, sometimes we're going to have overlapping interests, and sometimes we're going to have distinct interests. And our interest, I think, very much is in not going to war with Iran, right?
Right.
It would be a huge distraction of resources. It would be massively expensive to our country.
So there you have it. J.D. Vance, Prime Minister, playing.
And he tries to, right after this, trying to do the same thing. We have to, we understand totally what the United States is talking about, but we have to destroy the head of octopus again.
Yeah, I think this theory that somehow if you decapitate a resistance movement or an enemy, you bring that enemy to its knees, is something that Israelis have believed for the past 70 odd years, and it hasn't worked in any occasion. There are documented assassinations by Israel of something over 3,000 political leaders political military leaders in West Asia. And the resistance continues to reform itself. So I'd ask Mr. Bennett this: if Hezbollah killed you or killed Mr. Netanyahu, would that end Israel? Or would that lead Israel to be more reasonable? Or would it lead Israel to be more vindictive, vengeful, and cruel to its neighbors? Israel would not disappear because a single person or part of the political apparatus that rules Israel was eliminated. Just so Hezbollah will not disappear because of the murder of a particular leader. And I note in the case of Hamas, by the way, the Hebrew pronunciation is Hamas, I note in the case of Hamas that the murder of Ismail Haniyeh, who was a rather moderate person by relatively speaking within the ranks of Hamas. He accepted the two-state solution for Palestine, led to Yahya Sinwar's appointment as leader, someone who rejected the two-state solution and who is regarded correctly by the Israelis as a formidable foe. Now the Sinwar is dead, but I think you can see that the prospect is that Hamas will emerge from all this even more determined to do harm to Israelis than it was originally. So this is a path, this idea that you can do regime change, that you can decapitate societies or movements and thereby change their behavior or eliminate the arms of the infamous mythical octopus. This is not realistic, and history shows very clearly that it doesn't work.
One of the things that is important right now, we have two candidates, Democrat and Republican, Kamala and Donald Trump. Recently, Donald Trump was talking about Iran and Russia, and he said he's not interested in going to war with any of these countries. And right now, you watch that J.D. Vance was talking about that we are not interested in having a war with Iran. This is one side of the story. On the other hand, Donald Trump is talking about maybe Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, Tom Cotton. These people are going to be part of his administration if he wins. Do you think that these are all rhetoric before 2024 election? If he wins, these people would dominate his administration, and we're going to see. These are hardcore Zionists if they get into the administration. They're going to change everything, not just considering the situation with Iran, even with Russia. Nothing going to change.
Well, I would agree with J.D. Vance that sometimes American interests will coincide and sometimes they will differ from those of Israel. This is a normal pattern, and there is no pair of nations whose interests are always identical. There are always differences. In the case of Israel, I would argue that we have very few interests in common these days. We certainly don't share Israeli values, which are genocidal. And we do not share Israel's interest in a wider war, as Mr. Vance said, pointed out. As far as the ardent neoconservative Zionists that you mentioned are concerned, Mr. Pompeo, Ms. Haley, and so forth, I think we have to be realistic. These are people who have insulted Donald Trump. And Donald Trump does not forget insults. I think the process, I would bet strongly, I would make a big bet against their appearing in a second Trump administration, if there is such a thing. I know that Mr. Trump is clearly setting the stage by claiming that he's way ahead in the polls for contesting a loss in the election. If he loses, which I think is a possibility, not a certainty, then I expect him to reject the result of the election as he did on January 6th, 4 years ago. And I think that's very dangerous. And in that context, he might have the support of these particular people. But I don't think that would overcome his personal animus toward them. He is not fond of them. And I note also that many people in his previous administration have now come out and condemned him as unfit for office. Revealed episodes during his administration, which are frankly deeply disturbing, where his mental competence, his understanding of foreign affairs, his impulses domestically, were all authoritarian and anti-democratic.
There are many people, Ambassador, in the Democratic Party who are criticizing the way that Democratic Party is shaping itself, considering what's going on in the Middle East. And it doesn't seem that anybody cares about what they're talking about. Those people who supported Bernie Sanders, those people who are not right now, who are supporting Jill Stein, Cornel West, these candidates. And here is what Bill Clinton recently, yesterday in Michigan, was talking about in order to convince these people to vote for the Democratic Party.
About the hardest issue here in Michigan is the Middle East. And I have to be careful what I say because there's only one president at a time and none of us can get ahead of where we're going. But I think we're going to have to essentially start again on the peace process. And I understand why young Palestinian and Arab Americans in Michigan think too many people have died. I get that. But if you lived in one of those kibbutzim, in Israel, right next to Gaza, where the people there were the most pro-friendship with Palestine, most pro-two-state solution of any of the Israeli communities, were the ones right next to Gaza. And Hamas butchered them. And so then the people who criticize it are essentially saying, yeah, but look how many people you've killed in Ritalin. So
so that was what I referred to in my commentary before this about Bill Clinton putting the blame on Arabs, on Palestinians for the genocide that's happening. And that was supposed to move in the last hour people to vote. Of course, it had the opposite effect, and it really showed how what a racist is Bill Clinton, and how he was just carrying on and parroting and regurgitating the propaganda put out by the Israeli military way back last year in October 7. Thank you, and we'll see you next Wednesday at 2 p.m. on the Shaiv Nana Show. This is Zain Al-Amin signing off.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Donald Trump is the projected winner of yesterday's U.S. presidential race. The Associated Press made the call shortly after 5:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, after a win in Wisconsin gave the former president more than enough Electoral College votes to claim victory over Vice President Kamala Harris. While it may take some time to count all the ballots, Trump looks likely to win the national popular vote as well by several million votes. And according to an aide to Kamala Harris, the vice president called Donald Trump earlier this afternoon to congratulate him and encourage a peaceful transfer of power. Over the next few weeks, election officials in each state will officially confirm their results. The new U.S. Congress then meets on January 6 to count the Electoral College votes and confirm the new president. Republicans also retook control of the U.S. Senate, ensuring a smooth path for Trump to appoint a new cabinet and begin nominating judges to the federal bench. The Senate must confirm roughly 1,200 of the 4,000 or so political jobs to be filled by Trump. A number of incumbent Democrats lost their seats, including John Tester of Montana and Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who delivered an emotional concession speech last night.
We may be tempted to say hope was not enough. We might be tempted to second guess ourselves and question whether we worked hard enough or long enough. That is not our story tonight. We believe that all work has dignity. We always will. We believe in the power of people over corporate special interests. We always will. We believe if you love this country, you fight for the people who make it work. We always will. This is a disappointment, but is not a failure.
Some key Senate races remain too close to call, including in Pennsylvania and in Michigan. Meanwhile, GOP senators are expected to elect a new leader this week, as longtime Republican leader Mitch McConnell is stepping down from the role after 18 years. His current deputy, Senator John Thune, and former deputy, Senator John Cornyn, are battling to take the job when the new Congress begins. Control of the House remains uncertain, as votes are still being counted in key districts needed by Democrats as they seek to prevent Republicans from controlling both chambers, of Congress and the White House. It could take days or weeks to count enough votes to determine which party won the House. World leaders are reacting to Donald Trump's election victory. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called Trump's win history's greatest comeback and said Trump's return to the White House, quote, offers a new beginning for America and a powerful recommitment to the great alliance between Israel and America, close quote. Additionally, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed interest in developing, quote, mutually beneficial political and economic cooperation, close quote. During his campaign, Trump suggested he would end U.S. military and financial support for Kyiv and claimed he could settle the conflict in one day without saying how. In more news, Israeli Prime Minister